Good morning. It's June 19th, 2017. This is Wendy Bauer reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review. We'll begin on the front page with an article written by John O'Connor. This is out of Springfield. Online health portal done quickly gives Illinois headaches. A $94 million online health insurance system has some Illinois state employees and agencies flummoxed, and Governor Bruce Rauner's administration scampering to rid the system of bugs, according to interviews and documents reviewed by the Associated Press. State workers have complained of a gummed-up system that has rejected coverage without notice and inexplicably stopped payroll deductions. The head of the teachers' retirement system, where 106,000 retirees count on the program for insurance, points out that neither the specifications nor the system accounted for Medicare coverage. Georgia-based Morneau Chapelle was the only company to respond to a quickly executed November 2015 request from the Department of Central Management Services to design a web-based portal for managing health insurance options. The request was posted for just 26 days. Documents show CMS staff members were told to proceed without following guidelines for ensuring minority-owned business participation. The state has paid the company $375,000, but owes $9.4 million for more than a year's work. CMS hasn't submitted a voucher for the entire fiscal year that ends June 30th. Officials said that's because of the two-year stalemate over a state budget that's resulted in too little money to cover state bills. But from four accounts designated for covering Morneau Chapelle costs, CMS has paid more than $29 million for other bills in the 2017 fiscal year. A spokeswoman for Morneau Chapelle did not respond to requests for comment. The program replaced a paper-driven system administered by dozens of employees in CMS and across state government. None of those workers was laid off. The online framework frees them up to do, quote, higher-level healthcare work, for which there was little time previously, said CMS Benefits Director Teresa Flesch. She maintains the state will save $500 million annually when the website is fully functional as a marketplace where employees and retirees can customize their benefits to bring Illinois healthcare costs to a reasonable level. Richard Ingram, executive director of the Teachers Retirement System, said that could be a while. He said the program wasn't adequately tested before it went online. It was poorly scoped out in terms of what was required to do the work, particularly for the retirement systems, Ingram said. It's been one pain after another trying to implement the plan. Ingram said CMS has cooperated in working out the kinks, but he questioned the forethought. About 70,000 TRS retirees have Medicare coverage, yet Ingram said when he asked where Medicare options were on the website, developers asked, why would you need that? Tim Blair, director of the State Employees Retirement System, said few would question the need to abandon a paper process, but the problems indicate a rush. It just seems like it was done quickly, he said. CMS posted the request for proposals on November 4, 2015. It was open for 26 calendar days. Due to years of underfunding of the group health insurance program, there was an urgency to achieve cost savings so we could pay our bills more timely, and there was a significant cost savings associated with the plan design, Flesch said. Despite a requirement that vendors submit plans to ensure 20% participation in the contract by minority or women-owned establishments under the state's Business Enterprise Program, contract documents include a note that CMS has been directed to move forward without the inclusion of a BEP goal. CMS spokesman Richard Bossert would say only that the decision was made by CMS at the time of procurement. Since Morneau-Chapelle was the only bidder, if BEP goals were not waived, the state would have received no bids at all, he said. But the waiver note was dated November 3rd, the day before the procurement request was even made public. State employees have run into problems with the portal, too. An employee of the Department of Health Care and Family Services, Dale Webb, said it's a good thing he monitors his paycheck, or it could have been months or more before he noticed his life insurance premium payroll deduction had stopped early this year. The missed money was taken out of a later check. Aaron Runge, a correctional officer at Menard Prison in Southern Illinois, visited the website in November to add the family's new baby as a dependent. He didn't submit a required birth certificate and wasn't notified that his application was incomplete. By the time he learned, Morneau-Chapelle said the baby's $2,000 in medical bills couldn't be covered retroactively. Runge got the situation rectified through a grievance handled by his union. With the old system, you didn't have to deal with a company out of Atlanta, Georgia. They could care less, Runge said. You lose the personal touch and knowing that your situation is covered. The next article from the front page is written by Donette Beckett from the Herald and Review. This is out of Decatur. Meals on Wheels volunteers deliver more than food. Judy Rexroad has been a volunteer for Macon County's Meals on Wheels for nearly 10 years. They get blessed but we get blessed more, said Rexroad, who with her husband delivers lunches twice a week in Decatur. It's a way of giving back to a community that we love. This year, Meals on Wheels is celebrating 50 years of deliveries to Macon County residents. Volunteers were treated to a breakfast last month honoring their services. The program connects with people and builds relationships, says Rolanda Pinkard, former volunteer coordinator. It's something about being in service. Meals on Wheels relies on more than 500 volunteers to deliver meals to area shut-ins. Volunteers deliver once or twice a week or even a month. 23 routes cover nearly 300 clients a day. Each route takes about an hour. Deliveries are Monday through Friday, beginning at 10:30 a.m. Registered dietitians at Decatur Memorial Hospital plan and prepare the meals. Businesses, individuals, churches, and Macon Resources, Inc. provide the volunteers. It's a cross-section of Decatur, Pinkard said. The cost of the meals is based on a fee scale based on income, but no eligible client is turned away. Tracy Kelly receives Meals on Wheels every weekday. She has had a chronic illness for 25 years. She began receiving her meals in January after she suddenly lost 73 pounds in 10 months. They wanted to make sure I get nourishing meals, she said, and they have been great meals. Volunteers often add special touches, such as decorative napkins, or they bring their own grandchildren for an extra smile. Kelly said all of the volunteers who deliver her meals have been wonderful. Along with her food, she has received inspirational books, pictures, and other trinkets. Everything they give me, I'm grateful, Kelly said. People at the receiving end may be appreciative of the meals and visits, but, Pinkard said, the effect is greater. We are impacting the loneliness as well as emotional, financial, and physical issues, she said. The program keeps them in their homes. Such are the relationships that Meals on Wheels say many volunteers visit their clients on weekends and other days after their route. You actually become part of their family, volunteer Karen Bachman said. Like many other volunteers, Bachman delivers to many seniors who have no family living nearby. She has often returned to a client's home after the delivery to help with a chore and to drive them on an errand. We've taken them to doctor's appointments or get them groceries, she said. Meals on Wheels is on pace to deliver 77,000 meals this year. Greg Fitzgerald, Senior Services Supervisor, said the need continues to grow. Volunteers are important to the program's success. Along with the food, the visits have proven to be life-saving. We've had to call ambulances and the families, Fitzgerald said. It's a great safety check. Marcia and Larry Donnell have volunteered with Meals on Wheels for 5 years. They see it as a way to pay back the help they received. Larry's mother was a client for years. One day, a volunteer found her after she had fallen and called an ambulance. The Donnells were appreciative of the help Larry's mother received, and during a visit, Larry found a client of his own who had fallen. It was scary, he said, but everybody gets involved. For those who would like to volunteer for Meals on Wheels, volunteer coordinator Samantha Helt is always looking for help. People who are outgoing and like talking to people and the weather, shouldn't be a factor, she said. Potential volunteers will undergo a screening and a background check every 5 years. Jackie Runyon, life skills coach at MRI, Macon Resources, Inc., has 32 workers available to volunteer with Meals on Wheels. It is community service for the residents, she said, and they have a blast. Carl Nave works with MRI to deliver the noon meal whenever he can. The deliveries are a highly coveted job. Nave said the work is important for everyone, not just for him. I like to see their faces light up when I give them their meal, he said. I say, you have a blessed day, and that makes them a lot happier. And the sidebar notes that to volunteer for Meals on Wheels, visit cc.dio.org/programs/meals-wheels or call 217-422-6611. And the article is accompanied by a couple of pictures. Volunteer Sherry Slade delivers lunch to Tracy Kelly, who is on her Meals on Wheels route. The program recently celebrated 50 years of providing meals in Macon County. And the second picture shows one of the meals, which looks like a wonderful pork dish with gravy and several sides. And continuing on to the local page, David Fope writes, sign shows local gateway to Lincoln Heritage Area. This is from Lerna. Signs point to the fact that Coles County is part of the area where Abraham Lincoln spent most of his Illinois life. And a sign unveiled Saturday will show that gateway to the section of state where Lincoln roamed before becoming the 16th president. A ceremony at Lincoln Log Cabin State Historic Site featured the first showing of the sign that tells that Charleston is one of six gateway communities in the 42-county Abraham Lincoln National Heritage Area. Sarah Watson, executive director of the Looking for Lincoln organization, said the gateway signs will be a complement to larger signs on interstate highways. Looking for Lincoln will oversee the federally designated heritage area to promote tourism and help people learn the story of Lincoln's time in Illinois. It's a story we're really just starting to tell, she said. The larger signs that tell motorists they're entering the Abraham Lincoln National Heritage Area are already in place on interstate highways at the area's borders. The gateway communities in the heritage areas are locations with direct ties to Lincoln's history and with structured programs and facilities related to those ties. On Saturday, Charleston City Planner Steve Pamperin presented a model of the gateway community sign that will be placed at the city's entrances. The intention is to tell the story of Lincoln in Coles County, he said. Historic site manager Matthew Mittelstadt said Lincoln's family ties to Coles County show that his story took place in a large part of the state. Lincoln had close contact with his family, including his father and stepmother, whose home is featured at the historic site, until just before he became president, Mittelstadt noted. Each part of the state has part of the Lincoln story, he said. The heritage area is where most of the activity in Lincoln's life took place. Those long ties to Lincoln's history help take people to the places where he ventured, Mittelstadt added. The impact of tourism to Illinois' economy shows the interest of programs to promote history and get people involved in it, he also noted. And the picture accompanying the article shows Looking for Lincoln Executive Director Sarah Watson holding a Gateway community sign at Lincoln Log Cabin State Historic Site near Lerna on Saturday. It's a green and white sign, Looking for Lincoln Gateway Community, in the heart of the Abraham Lincoln National Historic Area. David Fope also writes an article out of Neoga, Paint Flies at Neoga Days Event. In the end, there wasn't much paint on the canvas, but the idea was more to calculate how to get the paint there than to create a work of art. During the Neoga Days Festival Saturday, the Neoga High School Science Club conducted a demonstration of a catapult-like device called a trebuchet. Small bags of powdered paint served as the ammunition, keeping with the festival's Paint the Town theme this year. The activity was billed as a catapult contest, though the different device was used and there wasn't any real competition. And that was fine with Lindsay Allenbaugh, who graduated from NHS this spring and was a science club member while in high school. We were just kind of experimenting, she said. It's nice to play with the variables. Allenbaugh and 2015 NHS grad and former science club member Kieran Effner fired most of the rounds during Saturday's demonstration, though others who watched were allowed a chance if they wanted it. Allenbaugh's family also contributed to the demonstration in another way, as her father David was the trebuchet's builder. The device differs from a catapult in that it uses weights to sling its firing arm instead of relying on the tension of the bent arm, as with a catapult. Amy Brown, the science club's sponsor, said adjustments had to be made on the device, plus other factors, such as the wind, had to be taken into account. It was a challenge to get the lightweight projectiles to stay on path and hit a target 30 feet away, she noted. It's a lot of trial and error, Brown said. David Allenbaugh was on hand for the demonstration Saturday and said he and a friend built the trebuchet simply because of an interest in such things. He said they have a concept for a larger one, sufficient to hurl small pumpkins, but added that the smaller version is the perfect size to throw tomatoes. He also said he built a small catapult for his son Jacob to use during a science event in junior high school. He said his son now studies engineering in college, the same major his daughter plans when she starts college this year. And a photograph accompanying the article shows Lindsay Allenbaugh launching a projectile from a catapult-like device called a trebuchet during Neoga Days in Neoga on Saturday. And Tony Reed has a short article on the local page, Motorcyclist Dies After Collision in Decatur. A motorcyclist died from injuries he received after a collision in Decatur Saturday night. The accident happened close to 9:30 p.m. near the intersection of Sycamore Drive and South Country Club Road when the motorcycle collided with a car. Sergeant Sean Genther with Decatur Police confirmed the motorcyclist had died after being taken to the hospital. He said more details on the accident would be available on Monday. Names of those involved have not been released. Next, Allison Petty writes, out of Decatur, Midwest Inland Port Studies Delayed by State Funding Holdup. More than 3 years after state grants were authorized to help develop the Midwest Inland Port, the city of Decatur is still waiting. The city of Decatur was awarded funding from the State Department of Transportation and Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity in 2014. The money was meant to pay for studies of the transportation needs related to the port, identify necessary improvements, and estimate their costs. But the Decatur City Council tonight will consider extending its contract to 2018. Work still hasn't started because of a holdup with funding, according to a memo distributed to council members. The Midwest Inland Port is a hub that aims to combine rail, air, and truck transportation, and city officials have lauded it for years as key to Decatur's economic development. The two state-funded studies would generally encompass much of the city's northeast side, including the Archer Daniels Midland Company's intermodal ramp, 27th Street Corridor, and proposed Macon County Beltway, a long-discussed project that would connect Interstate 72 and U.S. 51. In the first phase of the study, the city's consultant would analyze existing facilities and find ways to improve them and facilitate a full range of freight transportation options. The second study would focus on planning those improvements, including budget and schedule estimates. DCEO had pledged $250,000 for the work, to be paired with $180,000 from IDOT. The council voted to accept both grants in fall 2014. The city hired URS Corp in February 2015 to do the work, and the company was told to go ahead in April of that year. But just 2 months later, both departments ordered the project to stop because the state did not have a budget, according to the council memo. Later, IDOT told the city that it could resume work on July 1, 2016. However, DCEO did not authorize resuming work, so the city continued to wait. The council's vote tonight would allow the wait to continue until June 30, 2018. In other business, the council will consider a $413,000 contract with Wax Water Services to examine city water main valves over a 3-year period. The city maintains 535 miles of water mains and 6,000 main line valves, many of which haven't been operated in decades, according to the council memo. The project would open and close all the main line valves in the system, verify their location, and input the information into the city's mapping system. That will allow the city's Public Works Department to schedule repairs and maintenance, city officials said. And the sidebar notes that if you go, the Decatur City Council meets at 5:30 p.m. Monday in Council Chambers, 3rd floor, Decatur Civic Center, 1 Gary K. Anderson Plaza. Out of Monticello, Tony Reed of the Herald and Review writes, "Riding the Father's Day Express to Nostalgia." Taking a train back to yesterday for Father's Day sounded like a good idea to the Queeley Gaynor family, who found their ride into the past waiting Sunday at the Monticello Railway Museum. There was Dad Nick, Mom Kate, and sons Henry, 6, and 2-year-old brother Felix, all of Champaign, accompanied by Granddad Terry Gaynor from Decatur. They took a trip into the city and back on venerable passenger cars pulled by a grand diesel locomotive that was just a few years older than Granddad. "I remember passenger trains," said Terry Gaynor, 68. "I used to take the train down to St. Louis from Chicago." The Monticello Railway Museum specializes in mainlining nostalgia and offered multiple rides in a Father's Day weekend package where dads rode free as long as they had kids in tow. "My little guys like to move their toy trains and make them go wherever they want to go," said Kate Queeley Gaynor. "And it used to be and to be able to ride on a big train, well, they were super excited." The museum reported 281 riders of all ages Saturday, and more than 140 had showed up by early Sunday afternoon with more rides to go. Museum volunteer Justin Pippin, dressed smartly in a conductor's uniform, featuring a gold pocket watch, punched their tickets and reflected on the allure of the Iron Horse. The great age of passenger trains was extinct even before my lifetime, said the 34-year-old. And yet, I never knew a kid who didn't like trains, and that is what most of us at the museum are, just a bunch of overgrown 8-year-olds. Jameson Sally came over from Decatur with his daughter Rachel, 9, and surrounded by ancient trains, found himself trying to explain to her what life was like when you couldn't just pick up a phone and text Dad a Happy Father's Day message. Here, we're seeing how people traveled back in the day compared to today's travel systems, said Sally, 36. I've been explaining that people didn't have tablets, they didn't have cell phones, and they did things like read magazines and books to pass the time. As he waited with his daughter to board the train, other parents could be heard trying to explain to today's kids how train tickets worked. Sally wasn't sure his daughter could fully imagine history's dark ages. She actually had a problem trying to figure out how we lived without cell phones, he added with a smile. And the pictures that accompany the article show or are titled All Aboard as Monticello Railway Museum Volunteer and Car Attendant John Crawford checks tickets for the next Father's Day ride on Saturday. And next, the Monticello Railway Museum volunteer Justin Pippin braved Sunday's heat to dress for the role of railroad conductor from head to toe. And finally, not all passengers chose to ride indoors. This open freight car was available for those brave dads and others who didn't mind wind in their hair and bugs in their teeth. And from the local briefs column from Decatur, attackers saw it. A Decatur woman who objected to three women parking their car on her driveway was punched, dragged to the ground by hair, and beaten, according to police. The incident happened Friday afternoon in the 1200 block of East Prairie Avenue, said Sergeant Josh Sheets. The woman told police she parked behind the stranger's vehicle and went and sat on her porch. The women, two aged around 16 and a driver of about 30, came back a few minutes later and became abusive when told to remove their vehicle. One of the younger females walked up to the victim and punched her in the left side of her head, said Sheets. He said the assailant then pulled the 53-year-old victim to the ground by her hair and, assisted by the other teenager, punched her in the head repeatedly. Sheets said at one point two men showed up and threatened to burn the victim's house down. The three women fled after police were called, driving their car across the victim's yard to escape. They are all being sought on battery charges. Also from Decatur, son steals $800. A Decatur woman complained to police that her 13-year-old son had stolen $800 from her purse Saturday afternoon. The woman, who lives in the 1500 block of East Locust Street, had taken the money out of the bank to pay for the removal of a tree, said Sergeant Josh Sheets. He said she told officers she had left her purse unattended for a few minutes, and when she came back into the house, she heard the back door slam and saw her son running away. She drove around until she found him, but he refused to get in the car. The teenager is now facing a preliminary charge of theft. And that will end our first half of today's reading, June 19th, 2017. Please stay tuned for our second half. We'll return shortly. Thank you.